what I want to do is two things. I want to tell you a story, or at least read you a story, and I want to tell you something about, or share with you, a bit of work in progress for me. It's a project that I'm working on. And in doing those two things, I want to evoke, or hopefully evoke, this theme of the retreat on spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. The story is, it's about the events leading up to the enlightenment of the Buddha. And the text that I want to read you, it comes from some time after the Buddha died, about 500 or 600 years later. And it's written by an Indian monk poet called Ashvaghosha, who lived in the first century of what we call the Common Era, and in somewhere in northern India. But he's known as one of the foremost Sanskrit Indian poets of that time. And he wrote this text, which is called the Buddha Charita, the Acts of the Buddha, as a long narrative poem, a kind of biography of the Buddha. I've got a copy of it here, which was given to me, lovely pink cover. It was given to me some years ago. It's quite interesting, though, that when these texts, it's one of the early texts that got translated into English, and when you read them, it seems like those early translators, this particular one I just read in the introduction, the guy E.H. Johnston, who signed it off, was in 1934, so quite a long time ago. But their kind of spiritual reference point, if you like, was the Bible. So they tended to use a kind of language which is a bit biblical, thus and thou and that kind of thing. So I actually found a translation which is just slightly more up to date, and I'm going to actually read from that. I've got a digital version of that rather than actually reading the text from that book. But anyway, that's to come. The other thing that I want to do, if you like, is just to in fact, there's a bit of a request at the end as well, but I'll share with you, I'm trying to write something about what we call our system of practice, which includes these two elements of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And I thought that, first of all, I'd just like to give you a little bit of background to that, not to my work, but to that system of practice. So there are these five elements to it that most of you will have come across. In fact, if you spend any time in our kind of Buddhist community, you do come across this system. It's sometimes called the system of meditation and sometimes called the system of practice. So it starts off with what's called integration, and we often associate that with the mindfulness of breathing. Positive emotion, often associated with the metta bhavana. Then these two elements of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, and which I'll say more about, and the this element of just sitting, which is really interesting, if you like. Just sitting is a kind of practice of no effort, and all the others involve effort. But Sangharakshita, when he kind of gave this framework, if you like, to the order, it was in 1978. And he included this element of just sitting as a very important sort of balancing element to all the other stages, which involve making effort, even quite considerable effort. So, and all of that system, it's firmly rooted in the Buddhist tradition, but there's also a kind of synthesis that Sangharakshita did. And, so it's been around and used in our community for since that time, since the late 70s. But I thought I'd just give you a bit of the more recent context, that in the last year there's been a bit of a resurgence of interest in that. In fact, it's probably why this retreat is on this particular theme. And that resurgence of interest is quite interesting. And I'll just want to give you a few of the reasons why that's come about. The first one is, now is the time to be bold. And what I mean by that is that I think we've been practicing this system of meditation or system of practice for 30 years, and it works. I mean, I've been practicing it, if you like, for more than 15 years, and I can say in my own experience, it's given me a really good framework and a really good set of practices for my life. But also, we've got older members who have been practicing it for more than 30 years, and in my experience of them, I consider them to be outstanding individuals, and they're really, I'm happy to be their disciple in a way. People like Subhuti, who I just mentioned, and Padmavajra, who lives here and who was going to give this talk this morning, except he's in hospital at the moment, poor chap. But they're kind of outstanding individuals. And although it's interesting, sometimes the way that I think of them as being outstanding is not in the obvious kind of way as which you might think of, say, like a spiritual practitioner, you know, or a guru figure. So the ways in which I consider them to be outstanding is in, say, for example, their honesty, their openness about their failings, you know, their defects. So it's not just the kind of positive qualities that actually they, I mean, they all of them display a lot of warmth, trust, tendency to harmony and that kind of thing. But it's this area of honesty and warmth in particular, which I would say has been really impressive for me coming into this kind of order and community. And so I think saying that now is the time to be bold. I think that there's quite a considerable experience of actually practicing this particular framework and the fact that it works. The second reason is that it's an expression of unity and diversity. And I think what that means is it's giving us a language in which we can talk about our practice, if you like. So it's a language which is, it's kind of a set of core principles, if you like, which enables us just to have a dialogue with anybody else who's practicing Buddhism. I mean particularly in our own community, but I mean anyone else as well, I guess. But one of the things that's been going on in the order in the last sort of 10 years or so is a recognition that there is such a diverse range of experiences. I mean, I think that's just what happens when you practice, you know, a path that is, it's quite inward, even though we emphasise a lot of communal things like, you know, communities and study and so on. But, you know, Buddhism is essentially you're trying to change yourself from, you know, or at least your outer actions are influenced by what you're doing inside as well, your internal reflections. And I think there's been a recognition that it's been, you know, there's such a wide range of experiences we've just needed. We've kind of been looking for just some kind of quite simple framework in order to carry on a conversation with each other. And I think this particular framework provides that. The third reason is that there's been a recognition that we can present Buddhism to new people and not just meditation. So I think in our centres, I don't know what it's been, it'd be interesting for you just to reflect on your own history, if you like, of like how you learnt about Buddhism or meditation. Because for me, it was very much, I learnt meditation first when I first went along to like the Buddhist centre in Norwich for me. And then, you know, I got through meditation, I got involved or interested in Buddhism and the teachings of the Buddha that were not just about meditation. And I think that has been the case for a lot of people. And I think that because meditation was a particularly sort of enticing way in, if you like, just in the kind of wider society, meditation had a bit of currency, if you like, that we kind of rode on that for quite some time. But I think there's a recognition that actually people are interested in more than meditation these days, and that you can present some of the principles of Buddhism, you know, the Dharma, if you like, at beginner level. And again, this particular framework enables you to do that, helps you to do that. And then there's a fourth reason as well, which is recognition that although this system of meditation or system of practice is presented as sequential, it's a number of successive stages, then it's much more than that. There are also a set of principles that if you go into any one deeply enough, you come to all the others. And I think that's a really important point, and I'll go on to say why. And at the same time, just try and share with you how I'm trying to write about it, if you like. So one of the things that I want to do I want to produce like a little pamphlet, if you like, which is using language which is really simple. I think a lot of language that is written about meditation and Buddhism is quite, I don't know whether complex is the right word, but I know a friend of mine put a lot of our writings through this bit of software that analysed its level of complexity. And it said that most of it came out that it was suitable for people at degree level or postgraduate level. I don't know how it measured it to do with the complexity of sentences or the words that were used or something like this. So, and I think there's a real place for actually writing something which is a lot more simple and concise. But actually, having started to do that, it's really hard. I remember when I studied journalism some years ago, that the most respected journalists were, interestingly, those that work for the tabloid newspapers, like The Sun. And it's because even if you didn't like what they said, they had to be really skilled to get across a really complex idea in a few, you know, in a very small number of words, using a language that people who would say, like, no education or very little education could understand. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. And one of the things that I thought of, well, I wanted to start in that system of practice, I want to start with the last one first, so the one that's called just sitting. In another place, Sangharakshita calls it, he borrows another traditional language and calls it spontaneous, compassionate activity for the benefit of others, which I really like. Or you could just call it spontaneous activity. And the connection to that and just sitting is that they both have this sense of ease and of no effort. And if you like, what you see, what that is, it's the goal. That's the goal of Buddhism. You know, like in a sense, you could see just sitting as the goal, that you make an effort in order to make no effort. And so if you use this language of compassionate activity, that is what that is what the Buddha became, if you like. That's what he taught. And there's something in there which I think, but again, it's another one of Sangharakshita's teaching that he says, if you're clear about your goal, well, actually, that gives you some sense of purpose. Everything else makes sense. And I was just, last night, I was listening to some very good lecture on the kind of latest thinking on depression. And one thing that was quite shocking, it was just saying how widespread depression is in the developed world. That it's the, what were they saying? It's the number one cause of disability in the modern world in terms of time off work or not leading an effective life. It's higher than anything else, any other form of illness. Even in low income countries as well, it's always in the top 10. But in the developed world, it's the primary cause of why people have time off work or can't live that effectively. But they also said in this lecture that one of the key causes of depression is not having a sense of purpose or having an aspiration that is frustrated. That's obviously, there's lots of contributory factors in that. But I just find that really interesting. So having this idea of setting out a goal, if you like, a kind of manifesto, if you like, of Buddhism with a clear goal at the beginning, I quite like the idea of. And using this language of spontaneous, compassionate activity. Spontaneous suggesting that it's kind of beyond thought or you just act. You know, that's the implication of spontaneous. I quite like that. And for the benefit of others is quite interesting because Buddhism also says that as a teaching or a practice, it's good for you. So, but doing things always for other people is a bit counterintuitive. So I think how is that so? Well, I think one of the main reasons is because fear arises because we protect ourselves and we fear losing things. So things means our possessions, but it also means our views about life, and it means our health, and ultimately it means our life. I mean, at the core of all fear is fear of death. So if you practice something where it actually takes your identity away from just yourself towards other people in a kind of empathic way, actually it's a practice of fearlessness. The more that you identify with other people, the more fearless you become, which I find a very interesting sort of connection, if you like. So, anyway, that's the sort of goal, if you like. And then the first four stages, if you like, are practices to get us there. You could look at them like that. So the first one, integration, I'd like to just call it mindfulness. I mean, Sangharakshita does calls it that in another place. And I think mindfulness is quite well understood these days. Integration may need a bit, for me anyway, it needs a bit of unpacking and to sort of work out what it means. But they're essentially meaning the same thing, which is watching what you do, think and say all of the time. That's essentially what mindfulness means. I mean, integration maybe is a more what happens when you practice mindfulness. It's a sort of gathering of yourself together, all the kind of disparate parts of oneself. And Sangharakshita has this wonderful little kind of classification of what to be mindful of. So he says of things, you know, which means like objects, but up to including your whole environment, of yourself, feelings, thoughts, emotions and so on, sensations, of other people, and of reality or the way things are, which is a pointer towards the very deepest meditation of noticing the arising and ceasing of things. So the positive emotion, the second element or stage, I'd like to just use love. And there was a love is a bit of an overused word, and there's a reason why Sangharakshita, you know, well, that was the reason Sangharakshita didn't use it, I think, in his original classification. But I think I'd like to use it because it's a word, you know, it's sort of positive emotion, although it's about positive emotion, can sound a bit dry somehow. So I'd like to use love, but with the kind of subtitle of relating to other people, that's what love is about. And, you know, so it's a training in how to relate to other people. It doesn't mean romantic love. It means love as empathy, really taking in other people and overcoming our judgments and preferences about them. And this is where, you know, although we have practices like the Metta Bhavana, it's also where we emphasize ethical practice. And I must say, I've always really liked the way that Buddhism talks about ethics. It's not like they are commandments from God, you know, given to Moses and so on in the Bible. They're guidelines that say more or less, well, it's up to you what you do, but if you want some help in this matter, if you act like this, in other words, with greed, hatred and intoxication, you'll be dreadfully unhappy. And the Buddha says, like the cartwheel follows the hoof of the bull. Whereas if you act like this, and that means with non-violence, generosity, contentment, speaking the truth and clear-minded, you'll have a happy life. And the Buddha says, like a shadow that never departs. And I've always really liked that. It's always been really clear to me that actually, so it's saying, what it's doing is pointing out the consequences of various actions. It's not just saying, thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. You know, it's saying, it's up to you, but this is the consequences of if you act like this or like that. And just as for clarification, when it says these five principles, if you like, non-violence, generosity, contentment, speaking the truth, and clear-minded, contentment there relates to an ethical sex life, and clear-minded relates to not taking intoxicants that cloud the mind, so drugs and alcohol and so on. I think one of the best things you can do in this area is make good friends that you can be really honest with. I think friendship is highly underrated in modern society. And, you know, and I think having good friends and doing projects with friends, even working with friends, is really important. And I think the unfortunate consequences of that is that it places an intense pressure on our romantic relationships. As though they're supposed to provide all of our emotional nourishment. And I think it's not surprising that divorce and separation rates are very high in modern society. So, and then we have got these two elements, you know, which is mainly what I wanted to talk about, of spiritually dying and spiritually reborn. And again, I think Sangharakshita chose that language very carefully, that he really wanted to emphasise the gravity, if you like, by using death. But, I mean, for me, it does have that sort of hint of the sort of Christian born-again language, which doesn't always sit easily with some people, or I don't think it sits easily with me. So I understand why, you know, using that language can be really, you get across quite a strong message. But also Sangharakshita in another place uses the language of vision and transformation. And I really like that. I really like the idea that you have a vision of who you want to be, and then you transform yourself according to that vision. And in that transformation, you have this, you do have this sense of like, you have to give up something, you know, which is the spiritual death element. You give up all the things that are in the way, basically, before you can realise your full potential. I think what Sangharakshita says, your old ways must go before full potential can shine, which I think is a really nice way of putting it. Yeah, so how I wanted to illustrate these, if you like, was by reading this story. So what it is, it's an episode from the Buddha's life, or the Buddha-to-be life, if you like, Gautama, let's call him, just before his enlightenment experience. So I'll kind of read and give a bit of commentary on it as we go. So it begins, this is how it begins. The Buddha's left home, and he's left home some years ago. He's been in the forest, he's practiced, he's gone to all the great meditation teachers and practiced all these various austerities and so on, and they haven't really worked. And so he's kind of rejected that. He's just decided there must be another way. And this is what the text says. It says, and having bathed, thin as he was, slowly he came up the bank of the Niranjala River, holding a branch from one of the trees on the riverbank, which bent down the ends of their branches as if in adoration. Now at that time, Nandabala, the daughter of the leader of the herdsmen, with a sudden joy risen in her heart, had just come near. Wearing a dark blue dress with her arms decorated with bracelets of white shells, she was like the great river Yamuna, with its dark blue water and its white wreath of foam. She, thinking him to be the god spirit of the tree, with her lotus-like eyes wide open, bowed down before him and persuaded him to take some rice milk. The prince, having his body and health now fully restored, contained in his single person the loveliness of the moon and the steadfastness of the ocean. Accompanied only by his own resolve, having fixed his mind on the attainment of perfect knowledge, he went to the root of a fig tree. Taking some soft grass from a grass cutter, he sat down at the foot of that great holy tree, cross-legged, upright, at ease, hands folded in his lap, exclaiming, I will not rise from this position on the earth until I have obtained my utmost aim. Then all the gods and goddesses burst into unequal joy. All the wild animals and the birds fell silent, while the trees, moved by the wind, made no sound when the prince took his seat firm in his resolve. So what happens next? Well, let's just say the meditation was not a peaceful one. So to begin with, what happens is that this character called Mara turns up. So Mara is like a figment of the Buddha's imagination and the personification, if you like, of all craving and fear. So when I read through the text myself, I sort of translated his name to craving, or the Lord of Craving. And I think, if I remember, that's how I'll try and read it out. First of all, the Buddha is tempted by longing and lust. And when that has no effect, this Lord of Craving assembles a great army ready for attack. And then that's what I'm going to read, the passages from that. So then the Lord of Craving called to mind his own army, wishing to work the overthrow of the Shakya saint, and his followers swarmed around, wearing different forms and carrying arrows, trees, darts, clubs and swords in their hands. Having the faces of boars, fishes, horses, asses, camels, tigers, bears, lions and elephants, one-eyed, many-faced, three-headed, with protuberant bellies and speckled bellies, blended with goats, with knees swollen like pots, armed with tusks and with claws, carrying headless trunks in their hands, and assuming many forms, with half-mutilated faces and with monstrous mouths, copper red, covered with red spots, bearing clubs in their hands, with yellow or smoke-coloured hair, with wreaths dangling down, with long pendulous ears like elephants, clothed in leather or wearing no clothes at all, having half their faces white or half their bodies green, red and smoke-coloured, yellow and black, with arms reaching out longer than a serpent and with girdles jingling with rattling bells. Some were as tall as palm trees carrying spears. Others were of the size of children with projecting teeth. Others birds with the faces of rams. Others with men's bodies and cats' faces, with dishevelled hair, all with topknots, all half-bald, with rope garments or with headdress, all in confusion, with triumphant faces or frowning faces, wasting the strength or fascinating the mind. Some, as they went, leapt about wildly, while others danced upon one another. Some sported about in the sky. Others went along on the tops of trees. One danced, shaking a trident. Another made a crash, dragging a club. Another bounded for joy like a bull. Another blazed out flames from every hair. Such were the troops of demons who encircled the root of the Bodhi tree on every side, eager to seize it and to destroy it, awaiting the command of their Lord. Beholding in the first half of the night that battle of the Lord of Craving and the Bull of the Shakya race, the heavens did not shine and the earth shook and the 10 regions of space flashed, flamed and roared. So this is a meditation. In fact, it's interesting that it's what's going on inside the Buddha's mind, if you like, but it seems to be affecting the whole landscape as well, because it goes on, a wind of intense violence blew in all directions, the stars did not shine, the moon gave no light, and a deeper darkness of night spread around, and all the oceans were agitated. The mountain deities and the dragons who honoured the law, indignant at the attack on Gotama, rolled their eyes in anger against the Lord of Craving, heaved deep sighs and opened their mouths wide. So you've got this, you know, as though this huge kind of drama going on. I mean, obviously, there's accounts where the Buddha said what went on, and Ashvaghosha has taken this and sort of, how much embellishment there is, I don't know, but it's all to serve a purpose for whoever was reading it. Like this, what we can see is that this is like all of the kind of negative emotions that need to be gone before something new can emerge. You know, that's what it's about. That's what's going on, if you like. I'll read you a bit more of the attack as well, if you don't mind. Then the Lord of Craving commanded his exciting army of demons to terrify him. And forthwith that host resolved to break down his determination with various powers. Some with many tongues hanging out and shaking, with sharp-pointed savage teeth and eyes like the disc of the sun, with wide yawning mouths and upright ears like spikes, they stood round trying to frighten him. Before these monsters standing there, so dreadful in form and disposition, the great sage remained unalarmed, untroubled, sporting with them as if they had only been rude children. Then one of them, with his eyes rolling wildly, lifted up a club against him, but his arm with the club was instantly paralysed, as was Indra's of old with its thunderbolt. Some, having lifted up stones and trees, found themselves unable to throw them against the sage. Down they fell, with their trees and their stones like the roots of the Vindhya, shattered by the thunderbolt. Others, leaping into the sky, flung rocks, trees and axes. These remained in the sky and did not fall down like the many-coloured rays of the evening cloud. Another hurled upon him a mass of blazing straw as big as a mountain peak, which, as soon as it was thrown, while it hung poised in the sky, was shattered into 100 fragments by the sage's power. One, rising up like the sun in full splendour, rained down from the sky a great shower of live embers, as at the end of Onion, blazing Meru showers down the pulverized scoriae of the golden valleys. But that shower of embers, full of sparks, when scattered at the foot of the Bodhi tree, became a shower of red lotus petals through the operation of the great saint's boundless charity. So there you go. then eventually it kind of goes on and on. I won't read it all. It just kind of carries on, all these different kinds of attacks and so on. And then eventually it says, then some being of invisible shape but of preeminent glory, standing in the heavens, beholding the Lord of Craving, thus malevolent against the sage, addressed him in a loud voice, unruffled by enmity. Take not on thyself, O Lord of Craving, this vain fatigue. Throw aside thy malevolence and retire to peace. This sage cannot be shaken by thee any more than the mighty mountain Meru by the wind. And then this figure, if you like, this personification, Mara, disappears, just goes, kind of had enough, if you like. And there's just this little description at the end where it says, and all the army kind of disappears, with their triumph at an end, their labour all fruitless, and all their stones, straw and trees thrown away. The host of his fled in all directions, like some hostile army when its camp has been destroyed by the enemy. When the wicked one thus fled, vanquished, the different regions of the sky grew clear, the moon shone forth, showers of flowers fell down from the sky upon the earth, and the night gleamed out like a spotless maiden. So then what happens, I mean, it's the middle of the night now. This is all the first part of the night, if you like, this battle, this great battle. And then what happens is that something new emerges. And this, if you like, well, not if you like, this is the enlightenment experience. So traditionally it goes on and it happens in three stages, if you like, through in the last three parts of the night. So first of all, Gotama just sees like an infinite number of former lives that he's been through. And he can just see them incredibly vividly and clearly. I mean, it's a very mysterious insight, if you like. I don't actually know what it means. I don't really understand the idea of rebirth. But what he later described was that he could just see this whole sequence of former lives that he'd had, and he knew what his name was, what he'd done, where he lived, and all of this kind of thing. And it just went back. He said it just kept on going back. He could just keep on seeing this further and further back. And then the second, if you like, great insight was that he saw that this is what happens to all beings, that, if you like, that they who they become is based upon their previous actions. And then the third watch, if you like, the third great insight was like drawing from that the principle that all things arise on dependence upon conditions. And that accompanying that was this, he had this image of a which is very famous in Buddhist sort of literature and talks and so on, but anyway, it's a great image of a lotus lake. So a lotuses are like water lilies, if you haven't seen a lotus flower. But the Buddha just had this image that came to him without any conceptual thought, but an image of a pond or a lake with these lotuses, and the lotuses were like humans, like people, if in the sense that some of them were submerged in the water, some of them were breaking through. Yeah, but still a bud. Some of them were just about to burst open into bloom. And he saw that this is like the potential that all humans have. This is what he saw it as, that they actually, we all have the potential to see what he had seen, and that we kind of live in this kind of murky lake or this muddy lake. So what, you know, the way that in this particular narrative, the way that his insight is described is penetrating the truth to its core, he understood that old age and death are produced only when there is birth. He saw that headache is only possible when the head is already in existence. For when the birth of a tree has come to pass, then only can the felling of it take place. So that's how it's described, if you like, this truth of what's called in another place dependent arising. So if you like, you've got in that passage, you've got spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. If you like, what happened, all of that previous life of the Buddha, of renunciation and going to the forest and learning meditation, they're the kind of preparatory stages. It's like that's the, you know, integration and positive emotion, if you like. And it prepares him for this, Whether it happened over one night, nobody knows, but at least it gives it such an intense drama to describe it happening over one night, you know, this kind of a night-long meditation. And then after that, I mean, well, traditionally the Buddha sort of stayed around just gazing in awe at the Bodhi tree, at what had happened and what he'd seen. And then he went off and spent the next 45 years trying to tell other people about it. In other words, living this life of spontaneous, compassionate activity. And I just wanted to share with you, there's another image that I really like of the goal, if you like, of what a person can be. It comes from Japan and China. And it comes from this a work that's called The Ten Ox Herding Pictures. I don't know if anyone's come across it. The tenth picture is also a description of the goal of what somebody can become, like the spontaneous activity, but it's called Entering the Marketplace with Bliss Bestowing Hands. And it's another one. That's one that I think I'd like to use in my writing, if you like. Entering the Marketplace with Bliss Bestowing Hands. And what I like about that it also has this sense of ease from the just sitting, the sense of fun, and the sense of spontaneity as well. But it's also, there's a really important point in there, I think, that on the one hand, you see, that I think there's a misconception about Buddhism that it's escaping from the world. So I really like this idea that the ideal Buddhist, if you like, enters the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. So that suggests you actually entering the marketplace is just like entering society. But the important point is that you need to kind of remove yourself at least for some time in order to train the mind towards stillness in order to go back into the marketplace. Like, I think that's a really key point. You can't just, like, in other words, you need to get on the tree, just to put it like as bluntly as that, or at least get to places where the normal clatter of everyday life is not present. And you need to develop some kind of stillness and equanimity as much as you possibly can for that engagement. Like, it's very, very hard to do, if not impossible to do, to just in the midst of society. So, and I think what I like about that ox herding picture is that it draws that out, because the previous 10 or 9 pictures, rather, are the kind of a sequence of a seeker going off into the hills, and it's about finding an ox, which the ox is the mind, and sort of learning to tame the ox and that kind of thing. But, you know, the message there is that you do need to get away to somewhere that's a bit quieter so that you can come back. Yeah, so just to finish, I wanted to say there's something else about this idea of the ideal Buddhist practitioner, if you like, but I wanted to make a connection just to more what you might call ordinary life. Because I think that hopes and dreams are really, really important. And what I mean by that, I think most people have a kind of an idea of a vision of what kind of life they would like to lead. They have some, and it's not necessarily something that's, it doesn't necessarily obviously fit into sort of like becoming a Buddha. You know, like I had a friend who wanted to set up a motorbike sales room and repair centre, if you like. And you know, you think, oh, well, that's okay. It's a bit limited, but it's quite nice. But actually, if you asked him, I mean, if you help him make the connection, actually there was something in there that was really important, that he experienced his greatest sense of freedom when he was on his motorbike somewhere, and that he wanted to share that experience with other people. That's what he wanted. It wasn't just about making money and so on. And I think that a lot of people have these kinds of aspirations, that if you can help draw out what you might call the altruistic dimension, most people's hopes and aspirations for a creative life somewhere will involve an aspiration to help others. And that you don't get much help from society in working that out. You know, the most common thing is, well, you need to make money to be financially secure, or whatever, it's about status or something like this. But actually, you know, you'll lead a more satisfying life, I'm convinced, that if you can connect whatever your aspiration is to this idea of finding the connection of where it helps other people. And that for most people, I'm convinced it's there. I mean, I haven't quite worked out. I was thinking, well, how about an arms dealer? Haven't quite worked out the connection there. But you know what I mean? That's a bit, you know, sort of an exaggerated example to make the point that most people don't want to be arms dealers and so on. But I think that you know, these kinds of aspirations, they often get squeezed or frustrated. And I think, just going back to that point about depression, I think it's really important to pursue them. And I think that's what friendship can do, actually. It can help. You can mutually help each other kind of work out what kind of creative life you want to lead, and then make the connection to how that can really benefit other people. So, I mean, I know things, doing obvious things like, say, working in a hospital or something, but I think even what you might consider at first glance a kind of rather mundane job or something, actually there can be significant connections in there which can help, you know, can actually inform or give that sense of purpose or clarity. So anyway, I just think it's really worth doing that. It's remembering to, or working out, if you like, what your own dream is, and finding the connections. You know, because most often we're told to keep our heads down and be good consumers, aren't we? Really, that's quite, you know, it's just like the message that we often get. And surely there's more to life than this.